Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is a podcast where people tell me five things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish, but they also pick one thing they wish they could forget, something they want to bury in the ground and never think of again. My guest in this episode is Georgina Hayden. Georgina is a cook, food writer, and stylist from North London. She writes for publications such as The Telegraph, Delicious Magazine, and Observer Food Monthly. And in 2021, she won the Fortnum & Mason's Best Cookery Writer Award for her work in Waitrose Food Magazine. She's appeared on Radio 4's Woman's Hour and regularly appears on Channel 4's Sunday Brunch, This Morning on ITV, and BBC One's Saturday Kitchen. Georgina started her career as a food assistant, working at various food magazines, and then went on to join Jamie Oliver's food team, where she worked for 12 years, developing and writing recipes for books and TV. Her first book, Stirring Slowly, was published in 2016, followed by her book about the food of her Cypriot family, Taverna, in 2019, Nisitissima, the secret to delicious Mediterranean vegan food, which was a Sunday Times bestseller. Her latest book, Greekish, is out on the 25th of April 2024, in case you're listening to this in the future, inspired by her Greek Cypriot roots and, of course, her Greek travels. Sounds delicious. So here are the starters, mains and dessert in one, the lovely Georgina Hayden.
Hello.
Hello, Georgina. How lovely to see you.
Lovely to meet you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, after all this time, we've had this booked in for ages and ages.
Yeah.
I've had your name in the diary thinking, oh, wow, looking forward to that.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. No, I've been super excited. I love the podcast. I think it's brilliant.
Well, if I cough during this, I apologise. I have what's known as the 100-day cough. What a name to give something.
Same. I know.
It's horrible.
Well, do you know, I'm not even coughing anymore. I just sound quite husky.
Yeah.
I don't normally have this sort of level. Well, actually, I'm quite deep, but it feels deeper than normal. So I got a massive glass of water to keep me hydrated. But I mean, it's kind of an accurate weird name, isn't it? It does
isn't it?
Last.
When they first say it to you, you think yourself, that can't be right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, still going. We're still here.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Do you know what? I'm only now learning that I'm just having to pace myself because I still have, I've got quite young children.
Yeah.
Who are 3 and 6. So we've only just started having sleep. And it's just that thing, isn't it? I don't mind the late nights, but I just have to, you know, like I've stopped drinking because at the moment where you're on like a book tour, it's just that thing of like, if you're going to do the late nights, I can't have the glass of wine. I just can't, you know, it's just, that's got to give and that's fine. You know,
it's very sad though, really, isn't it?
I know. Get to the end and we're fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I think for a lot of my 30s, I thought I was still 20. So it's that feeling of just like, well, actually, yes, I do have to sleep. And I can't just, I'm not a Duracell bunny anymore, which...
No.
That's fine.
No, well, children will tell you that.
Yeah.
When they're 3 and 6, they'll make sure you have something regular in your life.
It's true. It's very true.
How lovely, though.
Yeah.
How lovely. And very exciting. I'm delighted we've waited all this time because now it's leading up to you launching. What I have to say is one of the most beautifully designed books I've seen for many years. It really looks gorgeous, your book, Greekish.
That's so kind. Thank you so much. I am super proud of it. It is a beautiful book. And as is the way when you're writing books, you work on it so, it's such a solitary experience, you know, and it's in your head and it's you're on your own. And then obviously you have these lovely, with food shoots anyway, you have these collaborative days with photographers and stuff. And but, you know, they're only a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels really like, what am I doing? And then it's out. I can talk about it now, which is really exciting. And I'm very passionate about food writing and cookery and recipe writing. So it's a real passion. And yeah, I feel very proud of it.
Yeah, it has to come from that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to spend all that time thinking about food, you have to be really passionate about it.
Yeah, it's my everything. You know, I am that, you know, my family had a restaurant for almost 25 years in Camden in central London. And,
I
was born upstairs and my life very, I feel like, I wonder in my sleep, did I speak to one of the researchers for my Big Fat Greek Wedding? Because that film is so accurate. Like, I've married a non-Greek. You know, I had the big glasses.
I didn't think Hayden was a very Greek name.
No, and no. I mean, I really, maybe that should go in the capsule because I've very, you know, anyway, I love my husband dearly and I do have slight regrets about changing my maiden name. However, as a result, our children have very big Greek names. So it's...
Lovely.
Yeah.
And your family are from Cyprus originally,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, they're from Cyprus originally. So
what part of Cyprus?
All over, actually. So my dad is from Limassol.
Mm-hmm.
His mum, Maya, who's still around, she's from Limassol. And then his dad was from the mountains, near Troodos. Beautiful, beautiful village up there.
Mm.
And then my mum's family are just outside Lefkosia, Nicosia, a beautiful, again, little village called Litharonda. So we go back all the time. We're going back this summer. And I have much more family over there than I do here. So, yeah, it's lovely.
It's a fantastic island, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
It's gorgeous. And I, you know, the older I've got, you know, when in the 80s, when I was born and when we used to go over as children, like I remember up in the mountains, at least going to restaurants and there being holes in the ground, you know, no toilets, you know.
Yeah.
And the change in sort of my lifetime, at least, is so vast. And as I've seen more of Greece, because obviously Cyprus is its own place and it's obviously it's divided and it's very complex.
Mm.
As I see more of the world over my life, I sort of, oh, it makes more sense now because it is such a mishmash. This country, this island's been trying to be taken over by everyone, all of the sundry. And as a result, you know, you've got everything from a really heavily Middle Eastern influence in food to the fact that we've got English plug sockets and we drive on the left side of the road, you know, whereas Greece don't. So it's this real hodgepodge and I sort of see all the sort of beauty in it now as well as a result, you know, more so, I think.
It's beautiful. Those fantastic restaurants. There's an amazing antiquity. I've never seen antiquity like it.
Yeah.
I had the most fantastic experience in Cyprus. My wife and I were driving just through the hills.
Yeah.
And there was this sign saying, you know, ruins. So we stopped and had a look. And we were wandering around and there was a little museum attached to it.
Okay.
And a guard who was sitting there very relaxed said, clearly, nobody else had come all day. And he was very kind. He went, do you want to look inside? And I said, oh, lovely, yes. We went in and there was a huge, huge Greek urn.
Yeah.
And it had rings running right the way round it.
Okay.
In one continuous line.
Oh, wow.
And he said, do you know how that was made? And I said, no. He said, 4 fingers from the top, walking all the way round, right to the bottom. And I said, it's so perfect.
Oh.
And then he said, and this is the bit that I will never get over having done this, Georgina, is that he said, would you like to put your fingers in it?
Oh, wow.
I know.
Okay, I need to go and find it. I need to go and see this vessel. I love that. And it's so casual as well. You just see a sign for some ruins and look at this. Yeah. There's this pot that is however old. It's just.
But I can understand how you love the place because the same thing with the experience of restaurants and food there is you can be driving by and see it. I saw a sign saying restaurant well outside of a town. It seemed nowhere. And we stopped and went and knocked on the door and said, do you know where the restaurant is? And the man said, here. And we then sat in his garden. He gave us food. It was just fabulous.
And, you know, you won't get a menu. You just sit in someone's garden and they bring you whatever they've made that day. Mm-hmm. And it's the hospitality, I think, with Cyprus as well. The people, and I'm trying not to sound insanely biased and sound like I'm just being hugely patriotic, because obviously I am also born and bred Londoner, but it is quite, again, as I sort of see more, and even just around Greece and stuff, Cyprus does stand out in terms of its hospitality. The people are so welcoming. You know, you say about this man who's just casually sat there in the room. You know, I can picture it. Yeah. I can see your man sat there with his, like, he'll have had a pack of Marlboro Reds, I'm sure.
Exactly.
You know, he'll have had his frappe. But the hospitality, you know, to have rudeness there is, I think, kind of unheard. Mm. You know, it is this small island and people are very passionate and kind, and they will literally open their home to you and feed you.
Yes.
And I just, you know, it's a funny one. If I was being really honest, it's not the most beautiful in terms of, like, the more I see of, say, the Greek islands anyway. You know, you have such astonishing beauty in the Greek islands. You know, think of the dramaticness on, like, Santorini or even Crete, and, you know, incredible, the beaches around the Ionians. And so whilst Cyprus might not obviously have that beauty, there's so much, like you say, you go off the beaten track. Like, for me, the mountains in Cyprus, for me, because it still has that oldness to it, it's just gorgeous. I love it. Yeah.
It is a beautiful country, yeah. Absolutely. I hired a car. Somebody said to me, this is the best place to hire a car. I always talk to locals and say, where would you hire a car?
Yeah.
And he said, this lady here, go and see. I'll introduce you. So we went round and we had a coffee, and I said, I want to hire a car. And she said, how much are you looking to spend? And I said, what's your cheapest?
Yeah.
She said, oh, it's 10 euros a day. And I said, she went, I could do cheaper. I said, how can you do that? And she called her son down and asked him for his keys, and she gave me her son's car.
Oh my God, I love that. That is so classic Greek. That is like, I can do it cheaper. You wait. And then, you know, she said, Yanagi!
Fed up about it.
Stop giving out my car, mama. I can just, honestly, that is classic. Yeah, and also, I need their number. So when we finished,
okay.
Sounds great.
Fantastic. So I'm looking forward to finding out the things that you've chosen to put into a time capsule.
Yeah.
I mean, you have such a varied and exciting life that you've lived, I think. Well, I do. I mean, I think, you know, 12 years working for Jamie Oliver, that's a long time.
Yeah. And actually he is. So I started in food 19 years ago in terms of, like, the food industry. Mm. Obviously, I grew up in a restaurant, so it's sort of my whole life, really. But 12 years with Jamie was incredible, and he's an amazing man. And I invited him out for dinner last week, and we caught up, and I now think of him as a mentor and, you know, a friend. And I just think he's someone to learn from. I mean, I would say my biggest teacher is my grandma's, my two yayas, but then my third teacher to be Jamie. I mean, you know, can't go wrong, really, can you? So it has been varied, but actually my first thing, am I allowed to tell you my first thing?
Yes, you do.
Okay. So my first thing, actually, I am going to tell you the best job I've ever had in the world, which wasn't working for Jamie Oliver, controversially. It was actually in Cyprus. And my first thing to go in the time capsule was karaoke.
Ah.
Because I am a huge karaoke fan, but the best job I ever had was when I was 19 and I worked in a karaoke bar in Limassol, and I was earning 15 Cypriot pounds a day, which is, I mean, nothing. Mm. And I would start my shift at 5 in the afternoon. I finish at 2 in the morning, and I would have paid them, quite frankly, just to work. They didn't have to give me those 15 Cypriot pounds. And I did a summer season out in Cyprus, and, you know, my family were all horrified. You know, I had quite a strict upbringing, as is the way of, you know, I think culturally and generationally. Like, I adore my parents. They live down the road from me now, and I'm very close to them. But I think it's fair to say that my dad in particular was, you know, Cypriot men traditionally very chauvinistic. There was a certain expectation from women of how to be. And to go to Cyprus and not stay in the family house.
Right.
And to work in a bar. I mean, oh, I was honestly, I don't think my dad spoke to me for a very long time. I was very much the outsider in that sense. And
she's gone. We've lost her.
You know, I came back. I was okay. And again, you know, it was a funny time for me because I was 19. I'd finished my A-levels at 18. And the only person in my entire, both sides of my family to go to university was my sister, who was older than me. And she didn't actually leave home. She stayed at home in London to go to university. So no one had left home yet. And I definitely wanted to do a degree. I was very academic, but I equally was just, I didn't know where I wanted to go. I was confused. I knew it was going to probably be art. Mm-hmm. So I took this year out and I wanted to travel. And I did go traveling again. So I worked my ass off. I worked all my jobs in my world because, you know, we were very working class background. Mm. And I saved up all my money and I went with my friend Emma around North America and Australia. And no one had left Europe before. So, wow. You know, that was a big deal for my family. There was tears at the airport. My mum was in pieces. And then I went to Thailand and I came home. And then within 24 hours, I left for Cyprus to work in this karaoke bar. So they were just all horrified. They were like, what have we done wrong with this child? You know?
Yeah.
Straight A student and we've lost her. She's just gone mad.
There's a job in the taverna waiting for her?
Yeah. What is she doing? Anyway, I did come back and I did go to art school and then university and it was all fine. And I've turned out okay, I reckon. But that summer in this karaoke bar, and then as a result, karaoke's just had this thread throughout my life, this really important thread from this very rebellious teenage year. Sort of that starting place. I didn't go there intending to work in a karaoke bar. It found me, you know, Mike, I can't tell you. It found me. The karaoke life found me. And then from my 20s living in Islington, where there were a plethora of karaoke bars and it was quite trendy. And that's how we would spend a Tuesday night going to the Birdcage on Columbia Road in Hackney on a Friday night. And I loved the Birdcage because you would have this mishmash of like proper East Londoners. Forget Columbia. I mean, Columbia Road even then was a bit shishy, but forget it now, yeah. You know, talking 20 odd years ago. And even then it was still a bit fancy, but you know, you had proper East End locals on a Friday night getting their hair done by with these sort of like newish sort of hipstery people, like kids coming in singing karaoke. You know, I remember once I would request to sing God knows how many songs. I remember once one of the locals going, you can't sing that one. It's my song. I was like, All right, fair enough. Mm-hmm. But I think the most important part for me with karaoke is the fact that it has a place in why I ended up with my husband. Uh-huh. So my other half and I are part of this friendship group and we're all very close. And he is an amazing man. We were friends for years. We'd go to Glastonbury together. He lived around the corner from Jamie's offices. We did festivals and parties. And I knew he liked me and this sort of relationship started to blossom. And I was a bit dubious because I didn't want to, you know, poo where I eat, so to speak. You know, I didn't want to shit on my doorstep. So I was like, oh, I was a bit apprehensive. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was on one of our weekly karaoke sessions. I was singing at that time. My favorite song to sing was Love Story by Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. And my friend, my regular friend to sing it with wasn't there that night. And I drunkenly said, oh, who's going to sing it with me? You know, and my now other half said, I'll sing it with you. And he never sang. He never sang. He was not the karaoke lover. He was there because, you know,
wow.
And he sang with me. And it was this real turning point in my mind. I was like, I'm going to marry you. And that was it. I saw it then for what it was. I was like, yeah, you're a keeper.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was that. And that, and you know, it's been part of our lives ever since. There's always been a karaoke session at some point. Our dear friends now own a fantastic bus called Ludo's, which is a pub in North London. And we turned it into a karaoke bar for my birthday last year. And you know, and that song I sang with my husband, it was our first dance, you know, much
of
his job anyway.
How beautiful. There you are. You see, anybody who ever just poo-poos, and I'll use that term again, karaoke, they're fools.
They're fools.
Fantastic leveler as well, isn't it?
Mm.
It can be really beautiful when somebody who can't really sing very well sings something and sings it because they love it.
I completely agree. And I think it's one of those things that, all jokes aside, and forget my experience with it as well. You know, I said about this bus last year that we turned it into karaoke bar and all my friends were there and some who say they don't like karaoke. Once you break down that sort of like, oh, I don't want to, or the stigma or the cheesiness, I am yet to find someone who doesn't enjoy it, actually. And in everyone, whatever your song is, the endorphins and that feel good, the oxytocin, is that the right word? I think that's the right word.
Yeah,
that feeling, you know, that's what I think choirs have really taken off now. There are lots of very trendy young choirs. I know friends of mine who are in choirs, and we've got a local fantastic choir. And it's not that church-going choir. These are pop songs, rock songs.
Yeah.
It's that feeling you get afterwards. And anyway, I'm a big fan, clearly. I love it. I want to keep it. I want to make it stay forever.
Yes. I think my wife's not a fan of karaoke when she goes with me because she says, oh, don't sing again.
I love that.
In fact, I sang in Paphos once in the bar. And after I'd finished singing, the man who was running it, who was obviously organising the evening, he pulled me aside and he went, "You could start your own bar, you know."
You've made it.
That was it, the ultimate You've thing. Finished. I said, "Thank you very much, very kind of you."
Oh my gosh, I love that. Forget Wicked, guys. Forget the West End. I'm going to open a bar in Buffalo and I'm doing it.
There's something very tempting about it.
No, jokes aside, I will come work for you.
Yeah.
And we will make this happen.
We'll do it together. You can cook. We'll start with food and it's going to be glorious. And we'll go till three. Who
Honestly,
cares?
It sounds like the best life, quite frankly.
It really does, doesn't it?
I think we're onto something.
I will hire us a car very cheaply.
Yeah. I love that.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, well, I'm completely with you on karaoke. I adore it.
Thank you.
And it's not just because I can sing. I love watching people do it.
I really do. You learn a lot about people. Mm. And it's such a, you know, I do think it's a form of therapy. And I do think more people just having a good old sing-along is just a great, you know, a great, great thing. So,
Yeah, when I was a young boy in Bermondsey, at New Year's Eve, I remember a party where we all went into the street leading up to midnight and somebody brought a piano from a house, put it in the street. And of course, people took turns to sit down and play songs and we sang for hours.
Oh.
And I think that it's the modern equivalent of that.
Yeah. I can picture that. I think that's fantastic. I was in King's Cross the other day and, you know, in St. Pancras, they have that piano. Mm. And actually, there were just a group of lads. And they were quite young, I want to say maybe teenagers, early 20s. And one of them was playing fantastically well. And then the others were singing. And I just thought, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They weren't, it wasn't like a drunk thing or anything. And it was excellent. And I loved it. And I love to see it. And I think it's just, a wonderful, wonderful thing. Or the fact that we can break down those barriers of like, oh, don't show off.
Yeah.
And the beauty of karaoke is actually you don't have to be particularly good. But, the other side here is I think I sound like Adele. And I definitely don't. I definitely don't sound. I am probably painfully average at best. But, you know, it's one of those, I almost have the opposite of body dysmorphia when it comes to singing. You know, when people look in the mirror and they don't see themselves what they are. I'm the opposite. I honestly... I'm just like, I just don't understand why I don't have a career in this, guys. Anyway.
But somebody's going to spot me. Somebody's going to spot me.
One day.
Okay, Georgina, that's the first thing to go to the time capsule. Lovely. What's your second thing?
So the first few things, I'm not going to go super emotional. I'm going to go for something very tangible here. I'm going to go for my bicycle.
Huh?
So my bicycle is such a precious thing, not just because it's a very lovely bicycle. The very sort of surface story behind my bike is when I'll start at the beginning. I didn't learn to ride a bike as a child.
Oh.
And I don't know if this is a cultural thing or a family thing. I do think there's a certain amount of culture and aspect of this. We weren't encouraged to exercise. You know, we weren't encouraged to go out and play. Mm. I had a great uncle, my mum's mum, my granny, my maternal granny. She had many sisters, but she only had one brother. She was one of eight or nine, but the one brother died from being hit. He was on a bicycle. This was back in the, you know, Cyprus in the 40s, 50s.
Mm.
So my great uncle died on a bike. So bikes were banned. It was almost like, you know, Sleeping Beauty in that needle. Like they were never in our life, you know? But equally, I think as I learn more about certain cultures and generations, you know, it wasn't something that was encouraged. Even now, when my husband goes for runs, my grandma's like doing her cross going, he could die. He could die. You know, that was sort of the attitude with these things. Why would you do that? You could die. That just cracks me up. But that was sort of our life as a child. Anyway, I was allowed to do ballet classes and there were certain things, but, you know, sports weren't encouraged. One, for women, you know, that was not encouraged at all. And also anything that was to do with being out was also not allowed. I was not allowed to play out ever. I remember very clearly the first time, the only time I was ever allowed to play out. I lived on a very suburban street in an area called Muswell Hill, a very nice area. And we were friendly with our neighbours two doors down and they had children, you know, there was kids the same age. And all my friends used to play out. That was the phrase growing up in the street, on the pavements, with the other kids. And my mum and dad banned that. And then my mum, this other mum, who's French and much more liberal than my parents, said, oh, just let them play out today. We'll watch them. And you can't make this up. We were outside the house, my mum, my sister, I, and these children. And this car comes screeching down the street in a sort of very curved, wild fashion, screeches to a halt not very far from our house, and a bunch of masked people with guns just start running down the street. Now, if you know London and you know the areas, Muswell Hill was a nice-ish area. It's always been, it was always quite pleasant and very pretty, whatever. And anyway, we later found out they had robbed a local jeweller's.
Right.
And were pegging it, basically. I mean, you couldn't make that up. The one time I was allowed to play out, this robbery happened. I was like, oh,
your mother
out.
And your grandmother are sitting there shaking their heads saying, I told you.
Told you so. I told you so. Look what happens. You know, see that? Look what happens. We're not allowed out ever again. So anyway, so that was my childhood. But I got it into my head. I think it was around the time the film My Girl came out. And that was very much of my generation of my age. Mm. And I really wanted a bike with tassels because the girl in My Girl, the film with Macaulay Culkin, had bike with tassels.
Yes.
Anyway, no one could ride a bike.
She does die in the end, though, doesn't she?
I mean, she does. No, he dies.
Oh, he dies. He dies. It's been a long time.
Beastings.
So you were safe. That's all right.
I was safe. I would be fine. It wasn't the bike. And I remember saying to my dad, it must have been my 10th or 11th birthday, I was like, I really want to ride a bike. I want to learn. Please teach me. And we moved slightly further out to another area. And there's a park called Broomfield Park in North London. And it's like a big ring and there's a slight slope. Anyway, he did teach me and I was about 12 years old and he taught me how to ride a bike. Mm. And I just loved it. I loved it. My parents were terrified, but I loved riding a bike. It was everything. It was freedom. In my teens, I was very much an eco-warrior. I still tried to live quite a conscientious life. You know, I have an electric car, but as a result, I didn't learn to drive. My dad's a mechanic and he was absolutely horrified because that was his thing in life. His kids need to drive and love cars. I actually do love cars now and I do drive. But at that time, I refused to learn to drive because I was an eco-warrior. I was vegetarian, vegan. Anyway, so my bicycle at that time was everything. I had this, and then I moved back to London in my 20s. I worked at Jamie Oliver's. He was based in Old Street. I lived in Islington and I had this very, very heavy Dutch bike that weighed way more than I did. And I don't know how I used to ride this thing, but it was covered in flowers. It was very old. I bought it off some man in Brick Lane. It was probably stolen for £50. And I covered it in plastic flowers and I would just cycle around the city with my bike and my parents were terrified. I still wasn't driving at this point. Anyway, I learned to drive when I was in my late 20s and I used to drive a transit van, hilariously, and a refrigerator van. And then I became a completely different person. But fast forward, my 30th birthday, my husband and I lived in central London and, you know, we were 30. We were engaged and we went on a walk around Old Street and he said, oh, we must go this way. And I just thought this is a very strange way. And anyway, we walked past this newly opened bike shop, very beautiful bike shop. And in the window was this cornflower blue, beautiful bike with a big sign saying, happy 30th birthday, Georgie.
Oh,
and
wow.
I got goosebumps even thinking about it. And I still have it. I mean, I'm 41. It's only 11 years old, but it's my pride and joy. And I would just cycle everywhere. And I could drive at this point. But I think it's not just the bike. It's what the bike represents. For me, it was freedom. Mm-hmm. It was a change in the way I was brought up, that sort of typical Cypriot, you know, misogynistic sort of upbringing of the men in my family. Actually, my dad is very liberal. I would say that he is very liberal and my parents aren't of their generation, the sort of stereotype that people might assume. My dad's a real, I would say almost like a bit of a hippie.
Yeah. But it's also very protective, isn't it, that thing? Because that's sort of, I'm your father, therefore I have to protect you.
Yes.
And it's my responsibility. So if you need to go somewhere, I'll take you.
Oh, 100%. He would never let us come back anywhere without a lift. No. And, you know, as a teenager, I was like, oh, Dad, it's so not cool. Now, obviously, I would do the same with my daughters. They are never allowed to leave the house. But but the reality is, yeah, the bike for me, the freedom it represents, even, and I said before, we weren't encouraged to exercise growing up. I never got medals for anything sporty. I was very academic. But the first medal I ever got was around that time. I was my late 20s, early 30s. And my husband and I did the London to Brighton on a tandem.
Wow.
To raise money for a cancer charity.
It's a long way.
Oh, it's a really long way. And I had broken my coccyx about 3 months earlier. So I was so drugged up. I think I'd taken 8 codeine tablets just to get there. And it was a micro tandem. It was like, I was mad anyway. But, you know, that was my first ever sporting achievement and my last. But yeah, the bike for me just represents so much. And even when I was heavily pregnant in lockdown with our second daughter, you know, you weren't allowed to do very much. I remember just to get out the house of, you know, being with this toddler and my husband, and I would just go for little cycles around the block. You know, it's such a part of me, and I just love it. And I, yeah, beautiful thing.
What a romantic man your husband is. How lovely.
Oh, he's a good
man. I'll sing that song with you. I'll sing your special song, and that persuades you. And then,
I know.
Oh, my word, what a thing.
I know.
To organise that and put that in the window. That is a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing, and he's a great man, and he understands me. And, you know, our upbringings are very different. But, you know, he's taught me so much. And in that, those sorts of things that we do together now, it's wonderful. And actually, you know, travel for us was the thing that brought us together. And actually, our bikes were at our wedding. We had our bikes and our wedding invitations. He turned up on his vintage Vespa, which is over 50 years old now. You know, I had my old Dutch bike at the wedding, and in the basket was all the confetti bags. So our life does revolve around, you know, we like to travel very much. It's our, the thing we do, how we spend our time and our monies and our energy. And so our whole wedding was around these bikes and this joint love of travel, basically.
Fantastic. Well, yeah. I should put that cornflower blue bike in.
Yes, thank you.
But I might attach a few flowers.
Oh, yes, please. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are some already. Listen, I've been my fault. There will still be flowers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Lovely. Oh, okay, smashing. Let's move on to number three. Okay, unless you're an Acast Plus listener, we now have to interrupt this podcast for some adverts. We'll be back almost instantly, or if there are no ads, actually instantly.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back. Okay, I've ordered a second large glass of Sauvignon, so sit back and enjoy part two of My Time Capsule with Georgina Hayden.
So number three is a bit more conceptual. It's a date. I would like to keep the 20th of June in my time capsule. And this one's a bit more of an emotional one for me. But the 20th of June is just everything. I've spoken a lot about my sort of childhood and my 20s, I think, up until sort of being 30. But my 30s were a really emotional and tumultuous decade. My husband and I, you know, very conventional in that we got engaged and we got married and we tried for a family, you know, sort of the first ones out of our friendship group, really. We only had a few friends with children, not many at all. And it was all seemingly going very, you know, we conceived very quickly and I was pregnant with this gorgeous little boy. And then it all fell apart. He was stillborn at term.
Oh, my word.
And so he was born on the 30th of May. He would be 10 this year. And he, you know, everything in my mind now is before Archie and after Archie. So his name's Archimedes. Hmm. And everything in our life is before Archimedes and after Archimedes now. It's sort of, that's just the way. And he was born on the 30th of May and his funeral's on the 20th of June. So 3 weeks later. And, you know, he was born at full term and perfect, perfect. And we never really know what happened or why, but it changed, it's changed our entire lives. And, you know, that is what it is. But that time, obviously, that grief and just those weeks, those early weeks as well, like even to think of them now. And obviously I've had all the therapy and done all the things, but it's still, it's incredibly painful. And those days, those anniversaries, whilst I don't really fixate on all the dates, because of which there are many, you know, for the beginning, it was very much, oh, this was the day of our 12-week scan, or this is the day we found out. And you sort of remember these days. And as the years go on and life changes, some of those days become blurred. But the ones that I always remember are his, you know, the day I gave birth to him, and then also the funeral. And the 20th of June was his funeral day. And then we struggled after he was born. We struggled to conceive. So there was many years of loss and then IVF. And it was these 3 years after were just horrific. You know, it was just all the treatments and everything was thrown. And I was saying to someone the other day, it was almost, I look back and I think, gosh, how it got to the point where I wasn't even sure where I was grieving him. And then I was also grieving the hope for more children. Anyway, the happy ending is we did get two rainbow babies. We've had two gorgeous little girls since. But I remember we'd had a few rounds of IVF failed. We'd had a miscarriage. And my third round of IVF was in the autumn. It was in September time. And it worked. And it's our daughter, Persephone. And, you know, we were there and we were going through it all. And every stage of the way, I'm terrified because when you've made it all the way to the end of the pregnancy and then you lose it, there's no point, you feel safe, really.
No.
So with Archie, I carried him for what is 38 weeks and 4 days.
Oh, my word.
So with the consultant, our fantastic consultant, Melissa Whitten, who is incredible, and she specialises in treating women after loss. You know, they very much said to me, if you were to conceive again, we mustn't let you go past 37 weeks just because of what happened. And because they didn't know why, you know, it was too scary. So when we got further along in the pregnancy and then we started talking, things looked like they were going well, we started talking about delivery. And I was too scared. Whilst I did deliver Archie, you know, naturally, I was too scared to go through that again. And I opted for a cesarean. And I said, please, especially because she was to be born early. And they said, just get her out.
Yes.
So when we were talking about the dates, now Melissa's an amazing consultant, but she is not always in theatre and she only has certain days that she can perform sections, as is the way with hospitals, obviously juggling people in rooms. She gave us these dates and she said, we need to get her out at 37. The first date is 37 plus one. 37 plus one, we will get baby out. And that date was the 20th of June.
Right.
And I remember and I just thought, gosh, I don't know how I feel about this. This is quite a lot. And actually... And then I said, so can we push it? And she was like, well, actually, the next day I can do would be several days later. And I just don't think we can. You know, and in that time frame, you're talking about a matter of days. It just wasn't worth it.
Yes.
And actually, I really thought about it. And I was happy to. I was happy to have, hopefully, you know, this baby that was going to be my first pregnancy that ended in a baby, a living baby. So to change the narrative. So whilst we don't forget... And I think that's a thing when you've had a late loss and then you have a living child, you never forget the other baby. But it was just the sort of hope, you know, I just thought, OK, I can do this. I can give Archie his sister on this meaningful day. And I did it. And she was born on the 20th of June and she's utterly divine. And her name, Persephone, represents new life. And, you know, she's now a very hilarious, funny, almost 7-year-old who regularly says, Mummy, please tell me why you called me Persephone again, because she now knows the story and she loves to talk about how she was the healer of our hearts and she brought us new life and she's very funny and also very matter of fact. You know, she'll tell people about her brother and she's like, oh, he's in heaven. He's not here, you know. But the 20th of June and also because it's the last day of spring and I found spring so problematic in those years, even after Persephone was born almost, because your memory... This time last year, this time 2 years ago, you know, the spring for me for a long time was this joyful thing. It was when I got married. It was when I carried my son for the last few months of his life where he was active and we had, you know, memories. I remember taking him going to concerts and I could feel him moving more. All those sort of things you cling on to, they all happened in spring. So then when he died, spring became this almost, it was taunting me. So for Persephone to be born on this last day of spring and for her to, you know, she is the goddess of spring, that in the Greek mythology, it just sort of, yeah, that it tied everything together and it makes everything whole and there's a completeness. And I feel almost bad not talking about my third child, Electra, just because I don't ever want her to listen to this and think, why is she not talking about me? Why is she just saying Persephone healed our hearts? Well, Electra completed our family and she's also a miracle for many reasons. But yeah, the 20th of June, just everything was lost, but everything was gained on this one day. You know, we had everything taken away from us, metaphorically, physically, but then, you know, we became parents to a living child and our lives were changed again. Yes. So yeah, very, very, very important day for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't imagine such trauma. I mean, my daughter lost a child at about 14 weeks, and that's
just
tough enough.
Yeah. You
know, but
that is tough.
But what amazes me is that still to this day, people make light of it almost. They sort of go, we'll have another one. You know, phrases like that, it's quite extraordinary.
It's really extraordinary. And I do think the story is changing and the narrative is changing slightly. We're getting a bit better at breaking that taboo. But can you imagine, you know, your daughter at 14 weeks, that is such a, you know, you're losing a baby, but the hope, the sense of hope.
That's it. It's the life that you expect.
It's
the story that you've already written for yourself that it suddenly is gone.
100%. And you know what always gets me is when people say, you know, they give a new mother a Mother's Day card on Mother's Day, for example, and they say, oh, you know, it's your first Mother's Day. Well, it probably isn't, because you're a mother, you're a parent, you're a father from when you see those lines on the stick. From the moment you take that pregnancy test and you know there is life in you, whether that is the cells, however scientific you want to be about it, it's because of the hope and the longing. Whether you are, you do not bring science into it. There is a loss there, and the loss is to be a parent.
Yes.
So, you know, that is what you have been dreaming of those days and weeks, whenever the loss is. Mm. And you are a parent from the moment you know that you are pregnant. And I mean, it's definitely, even in my sort of 10 years, I can see it's getting slightly better. I think there's recently that amazing, I don't know if you heard, they passed this bill in Parliament where if you've had a miscarriage, you can now get a certificate to say you have had a loss.
Yes.
And I think that's really important. You know, for me, where, you know, Archie was full term, I do have a certificate. But for people that have lost babies under 24 weeks, it's like that baby was never here. You know, nothing existed, whether it's 8 weeks to 23 weeks and 5 days.
Yes.
There's nothing. So that's amazing. And I think for a lot of parents, that would be such a lifeline to have this piece of paper now.
And it's astonishingly common.
Yes, it's 1 in 4. It's mad. It's so common, which is why it's almost more shocking when you hear things like, oh, you can just have another. Gosh, wow. But, you know,
I'm very lucky to say that my life has been blessed. But, you know, my wife did have a miscarriage, but very early in a pregnancy. But and I sometimes think about it. I think about that life that might have been.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think she even knew she was pregnant. You know, it was that early. But even still, it occurs to me. And so the idea of being at the point where you think, this is it, I'm going to hold this child. Yeah. The trauma in your life that never goes. But in fact, it does, as you say, it's part of your life. Like you say, before Archie and after Archie. It's absolutely part of your life and stays with you. Now, some people, that becomes a strength. And some people, it becomes a burden.
Yes. And also, I think, I remember a friend saying to me very early on, and she was doing it from a place of kindness and trying to sort of almost make sure that I was aware, but she said to me, you know, there's a very high statistic of parents when they've lost a child that they don't end up staying together.
Yes.
And she was almost saying it to me, yes, I guess as a sort of like, just be conscious of that. And actually, it did bring my husband and I closer together. And I think there was a strength that came from it. But equally, I can totally see how it's not even how you were beforehand if you had underlined, but, you know, it's a grief like no other. And I think that is probably one of the beautiful things about social media, I would say, where I have a very, despite the fact of having an Instagram account that has a few followers, I'm not very techie. I don't have any other forms of social media and I don't particularly love it. But one of the things I would say is good is when I lost Archie, there wasn't a huge baby loss community on social media, but I can see that there is now.
Mm.
There's a dialogue there and then people can, you know, I very old fashioned was on a forum for SANS, which is the stillbirth and neonatal death charity, fantastic charity. Mm. And I met lots of people through SANS, which was a real lifesaver for me. But you know, one of the beautiful things about Instagram now, and I'm sure other forms of social media, is that people are finding communities and are able to talk, whereas generations before, they didn't have that. So I think hopefully things are getting better.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm sure you talking about it will help people. So. I'm sure it will. I'm a bit lost as what to say.
No, but you know, my fourth thing for the time capsule is about my girls. Mm-hmm. So it's a slightly more positive thing, I think. I don't know if you're going to allow me to have this. But,
okay.
But I would like to do something for my girls. Is I want my books to go in the time capsule, which sounds like a very sort of maybe narcissistic, I don't know, thing to say. I want my books in the time capsule.
Your time capsule. What were you liking it?
I would like my cookery books only because I feel very blessed now and privileged to have these two girls, and they are my world. And I sort of, you know, I do the job I do and I live the life I live because of them, because I want to be around. And going back to my book and my Greek roots, and they're now London born, and their dad is from Lancashire and he's half Irish, and it's all a mishmash, and there's people everywhere. And they have a mum who just cooks all the time. And I cook all different foods because of my job. You know, one day I can be writing for Waitrose magazine, then I can be writing for The Observer, then I'll be writing a cookbook. And this sounds like such a weird thing to say, or a privileged thing to say. They often don't get the same dish again and again. And I think one of the things that fascinates me about food is nostalgia, and is the fact that you can say to someone, what is your favourite dish of all time, or your death row meal? And more often than not, people won't tell you the best food they've ever had or the best meal they've ever had. It will be because their granny made it or their mum made it. And I do also think that is the thing with roast dinners. I quite controversially don't love roast dinners. I think they're quite overrated to eat out anyway at restaurants. Mm-hmm. But in someone's home, they are the best things, you know? And that's the thing. You know, if you say, oh, where's the best roast dinner you've had? Most people will they can't really give you a restaurant, but it's always someone's home. But these girls, they don't have many dishes that are repeated in our house because of my job. But I try to make sure they have lots of memories around food, and they help me. And I'm trying to teach them about Greek food and Cypriot food. But I would love to put the books in the time capsule just so that when they are older, and, you know, who knows how long I'll be around for. We're having kids older nowadays. So if I'm around when they're grown ups, that would be amazing. But at the same time, I want them to be able to have my books, and they can cook the recipes, and they'll remember the things their mummy made them when they were little girls. Mm-hmm. There's photos of them in the book as well, and the pride my eldest gets from showing all and sundry her photos. Very, very sweet.
She's the queen of spring.
She is the queen of spring. And doesn't she know it? She loves it. And, you know, what an honour to be able to write books and to be able to put a bit of myself, my heritage in them. You know, I remember when I wrote my first book, the overwhelming feeling when someone said to me, I've made your recipe and it's now my favourite recipe. And I don't lose that. I've never lost. For any person that sends me a photo on social media, or they email me a picture of the dish they've made, mine, like, how incredible to think that someone in their home at this moment is making one of my recipes. It's really, really humbling and an honour. So, yeah, I would like my daughters to be able to have them, not to fight over them, because my mum has a little black book where she has written the recipes that we had in our childhood. And obviously we had a rotation of dishes because that was sort of the trend. And I think me and my sister are sort of just not discussing who is going to inherit this book.
Right.
So the girls don't have to fight. They can have a copy each.
Yes, quite.
Yeah. And then they can do what they want with those and carry those traditions.
I think I might put a few more in, because I think the wonderful thing about it is that it's not just them. Yeah. It's something that will go down the generations. Yeah. I'm sure of that. Because of the work you've done and because of what you've done, you will be part of the lives of people going on. Oh. They will say, this is great-grand's recipe.
Yeah.
Look, here she is.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. And actually, it's very sweet. My AI, who's still alive, she goes to church locally, Greek church, and she gets spotted because she's in my books. She's my, my muse. And she's like, golly, someone came up to me the other day and they said, and she doesn't understand things like social media. You know, she knows she's in the books, obviously. She's got them and she's very proud, and she's come with me to events and she gets very overwhelmingly proud. But, you know, she doesn't really understand that we've made these. You know, she knows that she's been in videos and they've been on YouTube or Instagram. I show her, but she doesn't really get the outreach. And so when people are like, someone saw me making vine leaves, what? I'm like, yeah, you're famous. Very sweet. Oh, brilliant. Very sweet.
And the fact that they can watch it any time. They can just click on it and there it is.
Yeah, exactly. And yes. I do think we learn, you know, that is my thing with cookery, my sort of, you know, what's woven in between my books and what I do. Like, you know, I have grown up in a kitchen. I've worked with chefs. I wouldn't call myself a chef just because I don't work in a restaurant with a white jacket. Mm-hmm. But I actually, it also annoys me that when, probably I'm going to have a rant now. It does annoy me when you have a sort of very stereotype of a chef, often a, you know, a man who's quite shouty perhaps, who looks down on someone. I just think, love, I've worked in, you know, like I'm working in television, food television, 18-hour days in a set kitchen, repetitive cooking 50 turkeys a day for a Christmas ad. Same, you know, just because I'm not doing, it's just different, you know.
Very different demands. You go on this morning while they're chatting with you. We'll just have a chat while you cook a meal and then we'll eat it. And you go, oh my word, okay, that's easy enough.
It's easy enough. Don't chop your finger and don't swear. Yeah. They're my two things in life. Don't chop your finger, don't swear. And, you know, that's the two hardest elements, I think. But the learning from your elders, I think, is just so important and just something is a massive part of what I do. So I'm very lucky to still have my gran around and hopefully pass them on to my girls as well. But
lovely. Yeah. Okay, right. There's a big pile of them in there.
Okay, thank you so much.
That's it. Lovely. We've only got one left, I'm afraid. And that's the thing that you want to put in that you'd like to forget.
Well, I had two thoughts. I was either going to go really big and go for, you know, misogyny and just have a rant about that. However, I've gone for the complete opposite and I'm going for something very silly, very, very silly. And I probably shouldn't really admit this on a podcast because then everyone will know what my phobia is in life because it's a very ridiculous phobia. But I really can't even say it so bad. I really hate the stickers you get on fruit.
Very good. Absolutely. What? They're really annoying, aren't they?
They're really annoying and really pointless.
Yeah.
And I have a slight, I can't even tell you. There's no, and do you know what the really mad thing is? It's not all stickers. Because I remember being a child and collecting, you know, like sheets of stickers you'd get in a toy shop. I used to love those stickers. Mm. It's like price tag stickers that you get in a corner shop. That they actually make me wretch. I'm sure a psychologist or hypnotherapist would have a field day on me. But I get a really sort of wretchy feeling when I see the stickers on fruit. And if I have to touch this fruit, and I cannot explain to you why or how, but I tell you the really mad thing. My three-year-old, I've never let on to my kids about this sticker thing. They have no idea. I wouldn't, you know, mad mummy. My three-year-old, ever since she was old enough and we were out of lockdown to go to baby classes, one of the things is really common when you go to a baby class or a kids class, at the end of the music class, they'll give you a sticker. Mm. Or you go to ballet and here's your sticker for staying still. You know, it's so common. She would go nuts.
Ah.
In point blank, she has refused to go to certain classes because she's like, no sticker. And I'm like, look, hon, you can go. We can go to the class. I'll just tell the teacher not to give you a sticker. Mm. I mean, how weird is that? Mm. I've never let on. She's never seen me freak out about a banana sticker or an apple sticker. But she clearly has it. She just would go mad. She cannot face it. To the point where she starts school in September and they give stickers to kids when they've been good or whatever.
Yes.
And I will have to say to the teacher, can you just stick them on her book or something? Because if she goes near a sticker, she goes mad. So anyway, I would like to put stickers in the bin.
Yes. I mean, the idea of having an apple and every single individual apple has a sticker on it telling you it's an apple.
It's so ridiculous and really annoying. And also, why would I then want to eat that bit of apple that's had glue on it?
Oh, yeah.
And then we're getting into the realms of packaging for things like fruit and vegetables. And I just think it's so, so pointless. Why do we need stickers and packaging? A banana's got its own packaging. I think we're fine, guys.
There's the young eco-warrior coming out in you.
Yeah, just leave the fruit alone. Everybody, please.
Yes, you're quite right. Georgina, absolutely. I should put stickers of all sorts into the time capsule. We'll bury it and you'll never have to worry about them again.
Thank you so much. I would be so grateful.
My pleasure. And it's been, it's such a wonderful time I've spent talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Thank you too.
It's been lovely.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, good luck with the book. I look forward to reading it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'll send you one.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Georgina Hayden. Thanks to Georgina for being our guest and for being so honest and open about her life. There are links to her work and the charity she's involved in the written description of this episode. You'll also find a link to Acast Plus, where you can get a bonus weekly podcast and this podcast ad-free. And there are links to our social media pages if you fancy following and engaging with me and or My Time Capsule. If there isn't a link to the theme tune, which is on Spotify, then there damn well ought to be, so that you can hear it in its full glory. It was written and performed by Pass the Peas Music, who are, of course, available to compose for you. Get in touch. This was a cast-off production for Acast, and our producer was John Fenton Stevens. We'll be back with more episodes very soon, but after talking to Georgina, I'm hungry, aren't you? Yeah, I shan't be going to my local restaurant, though. They were quite rude to me last time. The waiter came over to take my order, and I said, could you please tell me today's special? And he said, if you insist, sir, today is indeed very special. Happy? Charming, eh? Bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.